Bum bum ba dum bum ba dum bum bum ba dum bum bum ba da dum bum ba dum bum ba dum bum bum ba dum bum bum.
Welcome to Everyday Musicality, the podcast in which we discuss all things related to Gordon's music learning theory and how it can help unlock the inner musician that lives inside of all of us. I'm your host, Heather Scholdeis, music educator and faculty member for the Gordon Institute for Music Learning. In this episode, I chat with middle school choir and general music teacher and Gimmel faculty member, Andy Mullen. Hello and welcome to the Everyday Musicality podcast. Be sure to listen all the way to the end of this episode to find out how you can enter to win a free copy of one of Andy's books. Well, I am so excited to introduce my friend and colleague, Andy Mullen. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Heather. I'm a longtime listener, so I'm excited to finally be on it.
Oh, well, I'm super excited to have you here. Could you just start off by telling us a little bit about yourself? Who are you? What do you do?
Oh, sure. I am Andy Mullen, and my day job is I am a middle school choir and general music teacher in Burlington, Massachusetts, which is a suburb, 15, 20 miles north of Boston. And one of my night jobs, I have a lot of night jobs. For one of my night jobs, I am on the board of the Gordon Institute for Music Learning. I'm the chair of the Media and Communications Commission there. I am the president-elect, so that's going to be, pretty busy, as you know, being president emerita, pretty busy next 6-8 years of my life. Another one of my night jobs is I run a music education website called The Improving Musician, where I write books and publish materials and help out students and teachers on their audiation journey. And then my final night job is, if I needed another one, is I am a composer and a semi-retired singer-songwriter, where I write weird folk songs and compositions in tonalities other than major and minor, and meters other than duple and triple. So I'm pretty busy, and I keep cats. As you probably can hear in the background, I don't know if you hear a cat howling. Nope.
Okay. I actually don't, but I'm sure at some point my cats will be making their way up here to make themselves heard. I will never complain about cats in class or on the podcast. Cats welcomed. Well, I asked you if you would come on to chat for a couple reasons. So we'll have a couple of topics that we'll address in this episode. First and foremost, this is coming at the very end of a mini series of episodes all about the partial synthesis skill level. I know in MLT, we have all this jargon, partial synthesis, composite synthesis. And so in the podcast, I really am trying to break that jargon down and just boil things down to their essence and make it really digestible for people, which I know you also do in your materials. So before you go today, I want to make sure you share with us where people can find those. But I was hoping, since you're here to start with talking about partial synthesis, if you could just describe for us in your own words, what is partial synthesis? If you had to describe it in a sentence or a couple sentences, what's the general gist of partial synthesis?
Well, I think rather than using my words, maybe I should use some of the words of some of the individuals who taught me. One individual would be Jennifer Bailey, who's an amazing faculty member. I think she was one of your teachers as well. When she introduces partial synthesis, she says something along the lines of, this isn't a direct quote, but something along the lines of, to try to explain partial synthesis is difficult to people because they don't really have any context for the word partial, and they don't really have any context for the word synthesis. So when we're saying partial synthesis, to the individual who's trying to learn music learning theory, doesn't quite have much landing power. So I think that, first of all, we probably need a better word for that, for the skill level, and it's been bandied about. I love the word contextualization. I think that adds a nice ation onto, you've got generalization, so contextualization. So one of the big things that we're trying to do at the partial synthesis skill level is to, number one, marry the aural-aural and the verbal association skill levels to make sure that students really, really, truly understand that solfege and can connect the solfege back to the aural, and that the two of those are blended together. And another thing that we're trying to do at the partial synthesis skill level is to make sure that students have a good sense of the difference between our two primary contexts, tonally and rhythmically. So when we're teaching partial synthesis from a tonal perspective, we're trying to drive home the concept of the difference between major and minor, and making sure that students can audiate the difference with a teacher's help, the difference between major and minor tonalities. Similarly, from a rhythmic perspective, we're trying to drive home the difference between duple and triple to begin with. So those are the two main things I think are important at the partial synthesis level. I'll say one more, and I think that partial synthesis is a really, really important transitional stage, and it's a very, very important readiness stage. It provides direct readiness for being able to notationally audiate music, and I think even more importantly, it provides direct readiness for generalization verbal. So we're teaching students at the partial synthesis level to work with familiar material in familiar or usually unfamiliar order, which is direct readiness for them to be able to go out forth into the world and to audiate and to do that for themselves. We teach them how to do it. We teach them the things that they can put in their toolkit and how to go forth and do it on their own when they're listening to music on their own. Major, yeah. Minor, duple, triple. It's great readiness.
Definitely. And I'm glad that you added in a moment ago the phrase "to begin with," just to prevent anyone from making any assumptions. It's not like all we would do is major versus minor, duple versus triple. We can move on to Dorian versus Mixolydian, or Mixolydian versus major, or any two contexts you want. But yes, we start with the contexts that tend to be most commonly heard in our mainstream Western tonal music.
And once we teach students how to do that, we teach them the skill of how to use tools that are in their toolbox. Well, then they can go forth again in their own world. And when they're listening to unfamiliar music, they can try to do that by themselves and superimpose the microbeats. Am I hearing do day do day? Am I hearing do da di do da di? Or am I hearing something different? I'm hearing ba 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 ba. Ba, 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 ba. And if Scholdeis or Mullen aren't around as their teacher, well, they can use those tools to try to figure them out by themselves.
Yes. And again, just to prevent any assumptions, because I heard some people criticize music learning theory in that it is very Eurocentric or only focused on Western tonal music. And, you know, to some degree, that's true, right? Like, we don't have a content learning sequence for microtonal music or atonal music. And I think there is a lot about the sequencing in MLT that can apply to lots of musical traditions around the world, in that if it's a tradition that starts aurally and orally, then the skill sequence, I think, of MLT can mesh. But we're not at all trying to say that a certain genre or style of music is better or more important than another.
Absolutely, that is correct. But I think Ed would argue, and I think I heard Cindy, we have to make sure that we are not just tossing around names that everybody, you and I, I'll know these people. So for Sue in North Dakota, who's just listening and doesn't know who Cindy is, Cindy is Cindy Taggart, Dr. Cindy Taggart. Cindy would say that the skill learning sequence, when we're talking about, I should say, when we're talking about music other than just Western European music, the skill learning sequence probably would hold true, but the content learning sequences are definitely going to be way, 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 way different.
And we could develop them based on whatever the musical context is that we're living in.
Absolutely. I think I heard Ed Gordon at some point say, you know, let XYZ culture go get their own Ed Gordon, and then let him or her or them develop their own tonal content or rhythm content learning sequence. You know, he couldn't do everything in one lifetime. But I think the skill learning sequence will truly hold firm. And that is, I probably should add parenthetically, if it's the the type of music which is going to eventually lead to people reading music, because that's not necessarily going to always be the case.
For sure. I'm glad you added that in there, because yeah. And do we always need notation?
No. And for that matter, we can do aural, verbal association, partial synthesis, and spend all the rest of our time at generalization and improvisation and not really be in violation of the skill learning sequence. If we're just bridging across from verbal association and partial synthesis, we can skip all those notational levels altogether.
If we wanted, we could even do a composition with no notation, right? We just find another way to record our musical ideas, literally.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that was an interesting tangent. That was very fun. Thank you for taking that journey with me. So getting back to partial synthesis, we were talking about comparing the different tonal contexts and rhythm contexts and, in a sense, holding students' hands. I think, I can't remember Ed Gordon's exact words, but something to the effect of that we're at partial synthesis, holding the students' hands and showing them how to compare these contexts and recognize these contexts as we lead them toward inference learning. So that, as you mentioned, in generalization, they can then start to independently identify those contexts. Yeah, cool. Well, I could probably guess, but I want to hear what you say. What are your own feelings about partial synthesis? If someone walked up to you and just said, partial synthesis, what comes to mind for you?
I would just go, ooh, and maybe have some jazz hands going on. I love partial synthesis. It's really probably my favorite level to teach. It's really where true learning really, really starts. I love partial synthesis because that's really where you see the light bulbs go off in students' brains. They can echo as much as they want. Do mi so so va re ti dos. They can do all that echoing, but when it gets down to brass tacks, partial synthesis is where that real true learning begins. And as you say, they really start to become truly independent musicians. So, and as I think I previously said, it's just so much. It's readiness for so much of what we do in all of music.
Totally. Yeah, I even see that light bulb go on in my college students. When in methods class, we talk about RLR, we talk about verbal association, we talk a little bit about bridging. And then when we talk about, I just do a little bit on partial synthesis, not a lot, because that's, we don't want to make them run out screaming. but the first time they hear the two contexts side by side and start to compare, I see some of their heads snap up and their eyes are open wide, and yeah, it really pulls them in musically too. That's cool.
Yeah, I find that really, if I were to put some numbers on it, probably about 20%, these aren't going to add up to 100, but about 20% of the students that I teach really don't really need that instruction at partial synthesis. They can already intuit. There's a big swath in the middle of 50 to 70% who partial synthesis does the job. It breaks that cycle of imitation and sets them forth on their audiation journey. And then unfortunately, another 15% or so that it just doesn't do anything. And I don't know what, I could probably tap dance. And if there's no motivation in a student, then you sometimes you just cannot reach them. But it really does the job for the bulk of the students that are right there on their audiation journey.
Yes. And to be clear, I don't think either of us is saying, well, for those students that it just doesn't click, they're just not musical, right? It's just for whatever reason at this point in time, it could be identity kinds of things. Who feels like music is for them or not for them, or where are their interests, right? Like, it's a whole complex puzzle. Also, I think too, to emphasize that our success, our students' success with partial synthesis, just as with inference learning, relies on the readiness they've had at RLRL and verbal association, right? So we shouldn't shortchange the power of time invested in developing audiation at those skill levels. Because that can, have you found that to be the case? Have you found ever students who you get to partial synthesis and you try it and it just flops? And maybe it ends up that it was because they just didn't have as much readiness.
Yeah, you don't know if they're new to the district or new to the school, based upon their scores on a standardized music aptitude test, Maybe they're just not quite there, dot dot dot, yet. Maybe they're just not there yet, and maybe they just need another year of that RL and that in the bridging. And if we also need to start thinking about, well, what is the readiness for partial synthesis? And obviously, I think that RL and verbal association are direct readinesses for partial synthesis. But don't forget about generalization, RL. That's a huge, even though it's an inference skill, I think that generalization, RL, is a huge readiness for partial synthesis. Because if they cannot hear that these two things and are indeed different, then there's no way that they're going to be able to actually audiate the difference if they cannot hear that they are indeed different.
Exactly. Right. And just Zoom has changed something recently. I don't know what setting it is, but I'm
Original
having
sound for
trouble.
musicians.
Okay. Well, so I need to change that at some point. But it looked like you were playing 151 in major and in minor, I'm assuming,
Tell
just
me if you
by the
can
way
hear
you were
this
leaning.
now. Can you hear that now? Okay.
Yes. Very soft, but yes. Right. Right. So the
So
audiation needs to.
I play do mi so and la do mi. So if they cannot hear that, and maybe it's partially due to a teacher's intonation, but if they can't hear the difference between those two, then there's no way that they're actually going to be able to bring audiation to it.
Oh, and I want to get back to that idea of partially due to the teacher's intonation, because I found with partial synthesis, it can really challenge us as the teachers to be able to switch back and forth, for example, between parallel major and minor, and really do it flexibly and fluently and at a second's notice. And sometimes if we think, oh, they're just not getting it, sometimes if we really look at ourselves, we might go, oh, that's because I wasn't singing it as accurately and honestly as I thought I was.
What's that
Yeah.
smell? Oh, it's me.
I love that. I'm totally using that in my methods class.
An interesting tangent. Last week we were supposed to record this interview, this podcast, and I had a sore throat, and I was right in the middle of a tonal partial synthesis unit. So just because my throat was real raspy and I couldn't sing, I had no head voice. I said, "All right, sorry, this is not the way that Mom likes to do it, but I'm just going to do it at the piano." Maybe the results were a little bit better when they were at the piano. I don't know if it was that the intonation was so precise. And then I thought this might be a good study too, because I did it up the octave, that
Oh.
most of the students are treble singers, and maybe that resonated with their voices, with their audiation a little bit better. I'm not sure.
That's
Or
really
maybe it was because
interesting.
it was the second time that we had done it, and they were a little bit better. So you never know what the variables are, but.
Right. Or they felt bad for you that you were sick, so they were extra focused and right in middle school.
But we should add that, it's not ideal. I think the human being responds to another human being's voice much better than an instrument or to a piano. But I think that if your intonation is not that great, or maybe you're not a vocalist, do it at the piano. No one's going to get hurt. I mean, do it at the piano. I would
Yep.
personally rather see teachers do it at the piano than not do it at all.
Exactly. Yes. And with the piano, as long as the students aren't seeing your fingers, right? Where
Exactly.
they're not getting some sort of extraneous clue hint that's telling them if it's major or minor. I mean, actually, that's another common thing is that I think it's really easy for because oftentimes we have to concentrate more when we get to minor. So we might go bum bum bum. Bum 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 bum. And we unintentionally slow down, or our
Oh,
face
yeah.
gets more serious looking, or
A
something.
student just pointed that out to me. They say, when you sing La Do, your eyebrows go up, Mr. Mullen. La Do. Yep. They're our greatest teachers, aren't they?
Yes, they most certainly are. And yes, getting back to how we originally went on this tangent, the importance of generalization, hearing. Can you hear that those two things are different? So doing the same different activity with hands, bridging from RL. And also that's why as we're revising the learning sequence activities materials, we are making sure that we add in more options for bridging early on in the
Wonderful.
LSAs. And also maybe for some things like Jen and Cindy and I discussed this not at length, but we did have a thoughtful discussion about the hand signs, right? So two fists for same and a fist and a five for different. And we initially just kind of thought, oh, well, there's going to be a generalization RL LSA. And then as we got talking about what that could look like, we thought, but why do we need to be doing same different hand signs in an LSA? And does that make sense? Is that well suited to the, structure, the format of an LSA? So we're also including, we're going to have core pages. We're going to have enrichment pages. So if you see your students for more time or for whatever reason, you can add in these extra things. And then we're also going to have ideas for enrichment and classroom activities. So
I'm so
hopefully all
excited
that
about
will.
this. It's 20 years overdue, but I'm glad that we're doing it right now and that we're getting these materials out because, it just sends the wrong message to people that our materials are old and staggered. We're at the cutting edge. MLT is at the cutting edge, so I think our materials should reflect that as well. So I'm so glad that you and Jen and Cindy are doing it. Bravo.
Thank you. So getting back to partial synthesis, you've kind of alluded to this, but I'm curious to know what your own experience teaching partial synthesis have been like with your students, especially at the middle school level.
It's evolved a lot. I think about maybe the partial synthesis teacher I was 10 years ago. I probably did it right by the book. And by the book, I mean by the learning sequence books, Tonal Register Book One, Rhythm Register Book One. And then I took Elementary General One and then Elementary General two times. And that's really, I think, where my partial synthesis skills improved a lot. Just seeing
Same.
how you and Jen and Jill Reese and I guess that's it. Who was the other person? And Cindy, how you took your experience and modified those LSAs that were written when? Late 70s, early 80s, I would assume. He probably wrote those learning sequence activities. And there's gold in there. There is indeed liquid gold in the basic techniques that Ed wrote, but I think that modifying them is really, really important. One major modification, I think I learned this both from you and Jen Bailey, is that I only do one pattern at a time. I don't do both patterns.
One
It's
series, you mean?
one series of patterns. Yes, thank you. It's just so hard both for students to remember in the first set of patterns, I was audiating blah, 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 blah. And the second series, like, first of all, I forget.
Right.
I can only remember one set of patterns. So that's evolved a lot. My notation system, how I mark things, has changed a lot. For instance, say we're doing a major versus minor one, and I'll sing the pattern. Bum, bum, bum. As I'm singing the pattern, I pick which kid is going to do it, and I write down a big M if it's going to be major. So I pick the kid. Bum, 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 bum. And then I say so everybody gets a chance to audiate. Nobody knows beforehand, so everybody's audiating. And I say, if we're doing it the first time, Freddie, were you hearing do mi so or la do mi? And then if he gets it right, I circle it. That means that he got the major one right. If he or she or they get it wrong, I put an X over the M. So that way I know that they got the major one wrong. And that maybe the next time I go back, try it again. And then I do the next one. Say it's a minor one. Bum, bum, bum. I write down a little lowercase M with three little squiggles, just so I know that it's a minor one. And then again, if they get it right, I circle it, and if they get it wrong, I put an X over it. That just helps me with organization and knowing which kid got which patterns.
Right. I just love hearing how different teachers mark, even marking, it can be so individualized, whatever works for you. Also with that strategy, when you gave a kid a turn, in addition to knowing wh whether they got to try the major or the minor, if they tried and got it wrong versus if you're only marking if they got it correct. That's why I'm not the only one I think that figured this out, but I'll use a dot. So in my little box of the student, on my however I'm marking, I use if on the page the major series comes first and the minor series, I use the left side of the box as the major and the right side as the minor. And if they were to miss it, I just put a little dot on either the left or the right side. So I just love hearing all these different strategies for marking because, everybody's different. Everybody has a different thing that clicks with them that they can use. The most important thing I think for learning sequence activities is that you can use it really fluently, flexibly, quickly. So just finding a way of marking that you can just boom, boom, boom,
yep.
Let it roll.
I used a little dot for if they answer a question, because sometimes I'll just throw that. Freddie, do you agree? Dot.
Ooh.
Margaret, do you agree? Dot. Are you sure? And channel my inner Sydney Taggart. Are you sure?
Right. Make them think they're wrong to see if they're like, no. I mean, it was the other one. And then you know that they were just guessing.
Yep. And then from
like
a duple, erase that from your audiation. From a rhythmic perspective, I put a D and a T for the duple pattern and the triple pattern. Another thing that has changed for me rhythmically is that I do partial synthesis a lot earlier. I do partial synthesis after macro beats and micro beats. Because if I want them to read do's and do days, then I think they should have a partial synthesis experience. So that learning sequence activity sounds something like this. Yeah, there's the whole setup. Well, listen, these two sets of patterns. First, ba, 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 ba. Second, ba, 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 ba. And I do the explanation. In the first set of patterns, I was hearing do, do, day, do, day, do. So what was the meter I was audiating? Duple. And then I channel my inner Heather Scholdice, and I say, I'll prove it to you. You chant do, day, and I'll do the patterns. And then they chant do, day. And I say, see what happens when we do it wrong. Could you chant do, daddy, for me? Do, daddy, I'll chant the sentence. Bop, 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 bop. And then it's just a hot mess. No, that's not right.
Love it.
And then you do the other one, do the explanation, and then this, I think, is my own technique, and I like it, if I do say so myself. I'm going to chant a sentence, one of these musical sentences, and your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to chant the microbeat that you're hearing. Let's do it together. Ba, 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 ba. Do day. So have them chant it in context. Ba, 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 ba. Do da dee. So I only want one, and then I go around to each kid, and I cook. Watch Jen Bailey do those. She cooks, and I try to go pretty good tempo. And I'm sweeping the room, so nobody knows who it's going to be. Then breathe, and then the hammer of justice points to a kid, and then they say the microbeat that they're audio. So that works out pretty well, and I can get through a lot of kids, and I like that the microbeat is in context.
Yes, and I do something similar, but I like that yours cuts down on those little fractions of seconds that really add up, you know, over time. So I would chant the patterns, and then whatever the ending was, I would say, what were the microbeats? So I'm chanting like a prompt in rhythm, and then having them chant in rhythm, because then I know they're audiating. But I like how once they're acclimated to how it works, I don't even have to say what were the microbeats, because they can just know ba 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 ba, and I gesture, and boom, they know to just chant the microbeats. Love it.
And I tell them as well. So ba 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 ba, do day. It was do day. Move on. Ba. Ba 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 ba. Do day. It was do daddy. But no, that's okay. I mean, and I every time the first kid gets it wrong, again, I channel my inner Cindy Tagger and I say, stop the timer, because we always do 3-minute timers. What was your timer you used? The pig? Did you have a pig timer?
Chicken.
chicken timer. I stop the first time somebody gets it wrong and say, I'm glad that that happened. I love it when students get it wrong, because every time you get it wrong, you are teaching yourself. So please continue to get it wrong. I mean, they obviously don't get it wrong, but I want to encourage them that being wrong is okay, that it's all part of the learning process.
That is so important. That is, in fact, one of the things I found in my dissertation research, which was on a particular teacher who believes everybody is musical rather than believing in innate selective talent, and kind of how that belief that all students are musical comes out in the classroom. And that was one of the big findings, that the classroom culture we create really makes the difference in facilitating whether each student can blossom, you know, in terms of growing into their musicianship versus not. It's modeling those healthy responses to mistakes, making it just totally normalized.
Absolutely.
It's totally normal to make a mistake.
Yep.
It's great even when we make mistakes, because then we know what we still want to learn next.
Yes, please give me your mistakes. I think that's a quote from Chris Muntz, who's a great choral educator. Please, I want to hear your mistakes. Please give me your mistakes.
Love
that's
that.
great.
Also, I just have to share, I'm sorry, it's totally a tangent, the chicken thing that you mentioned. I make my undergrads teach LSAs. About halfway through the semester, when they have basics of starting to, you know, make up patterns and gestures and all the, you know, that kind of stuff, I make them teach LSAs. And we were just talking about how hard it is, and how you might think you taught for 30 seconds, or you might think you taught for, you know, 5 minutes of LSAs, when really it's been 30 seconds. Right. And I brought up that when I had that chicken, it was really for me, so I would know how much time had actually passed. And I have in my methods class right now one of my former elementary students. It's like a complete circle
Oh
of
my
life moment.
gosh.
Oh my gosh. It's amazing. And he remembers the one day I set the chicken and happened to go, "Chicken is chicken." And then they laughed and loved it. And then I did it in the next class and they loved it. And then it was a thing. Anyway.
Oh, that's great.
That's very cool. When he
Sunrise,
went up there and
sunset.
taught his
Oh my
first
gosh.
LSA, the other students, I mean, like, he did pretty well. And the other students, we were all just kind of like, "Huh, how'd you do that?" And he's like, "I was just picturing you." Oh,
we all say
I don't want
channeling
to
our
just
inner.
replicate myself, but that was sweet. Go ahead. What were you saying?
I was going to say, we all of us MLT teachers, we all say, "All right, I'm going to channel my inner Shoal Dice and do X, Y, Z. Okay, I'm going to." And the macro beats are, "I'll do it." Absolutely.
And also, it's not like the only people worth channeling are, you know, like these higher ups, faculty, like, everybody has something worth channeling, right? I love that. I learned just as much from participants in PDLCs and from my method students. I'm always getting new ideas. I love that. And I hope I remembered to give credit when I do steal those things.
Yes. Don't evade your eyes, plagiarize, but just call it research.
Yes.
One more thing I'd like to say is I've spent a lot more time recently in my partial synthesis time after we do the LSAs. I bridge a lot to generalization verbal, a lot of bridging, because Ed always says that when we bridge, we don't so much learn about the level to which we're bridging, but the level from which we're bridging. So when we bridge from partial synthesis, we learn a lot more about partial synthesis. And if people don't know Kahoot, do people know Kahoot? I love, 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 love Kahoot.
Please talk about it.
Okay, so Kahoot is this game. So there's two games that I use all the time in my classroom. The first one is Kahoot, and the second one is Blooket, Blooket. I always thought it was pronounced Blooket, but on the website it says Blooket. So with Kahoot, it's basically a quiz game. And in my class, it becomes what I call a lollipop opportunity. So it's a game where there's an opportunity for the top three people to win lollipops, lollipop opportunities. So we do our work at partial synthesis, and whether it be major versus minor or duple versus triple, I take these little tracks from those great CDs that Dick and Ed and Chris made, like You Are My Sunshine, Don Gato. There's just these little 25 to 45 second songs, and they're in any combination of major, minor, duple, triple. And so I make these little playlists of them. And so it's just a major versus minor game or a duple versus triple game. And so I put it on and it starts playing a song, and then they all log into Kahoot, and then the top three people at the end, the people that got the best score and the fastest, they get their lollipops. But they just love them. So I have these. I bet I could take a screenshot of the lists if people want to see these curated lists, and they can get my Kahoots for free somewhere. But they're just so fun. Great opportunity for them to practice major versus minor in, and duple versus triple in quote unquote real music, because it's good to use real music. And some of them are tricky because they do bounce around. They're not in the same key or not in the same tempo, but just a lot of fun. And then I find that after we go back to partial synthesis, it seems a lot easier because we've spent some time at this crazy thing like, oh, we got to hear major versus minor or duple versus triple with these songs from out in the wild. So lots of fun.
Right. Yes. And any way that we can have some sort of incentive or they're motivated, all the better. Yeah, that's
And then
great.
finally, after 3 or 4 or 5 classes of partial synthesis LSAs, partial synthesis classroom activities, and generalization classroom activities, then I assess with a quiz. I just give a good old-fashioned quiz. And I feel good about using that as an assessment because I only use familiar patterns in unfamiliar order. The same patterns that I've been using in the LSAs, that's the basis for a quiz. And that gives me really, really good data. Fantastic data. And if I get like an average of 8 out of 10 on this little simple 10-question quiz that Google grades by itself, I feel really, really good about my work.
And I mean, that is an instance where a written assessment, written, whether it's clicking something or whatever, that makes sense, right? We can't really do a written assessment to measure someone's singing accuracy, but we can when it comes to can you recognize duple versus triple? And thank you for emphasizing that it's familiar patterns, because that was one thing, how you said you didn't really own partial synthesis until you took your elementary general level 2. I was the same way, because it was in level 2 when I realized, oh, I thought I was doing partial synthesis and that wasn't, because I was just chanting whatever rhythm I wanted on bah in duple or triple. So I was actually doing generalization, right?
Right. Which is not a bad thing as long as you know what you're doing.
Exactly. You got to be aware. Yep. Cool. Oh, little side note. When you took level 2, did I share my Twister game?
You did share your Twister game. You did.
Just
Yes.
like that's when you were talking about Kahoot and like finding game ways to motivate. That was always the best way when you get to a new school and your students don't know, or new students who still need verbal association but aren't particularly motivated to learn the terms, right? Major, minor, duple, triple, macro, all that stuff. I pulled out that Twister board that I made and they loved it. They quickly wanted to know, what's microbeats, do days what, and do
Yeah.
daddy is what. And so it was great just for drilling terms for verbal association. Then you could turn it into partial synthesis. As long as you're making sure that you're using familiar patterns, you could chant a series of patterns and they could find duple versus triple, or you could sing, because I had 4 different colors of circles, and there was major for one color and minor for another color, duple meter for a color, triple meter. So we were mixing. It wasn't just all tonal or all rhythm, but it was super fun way. And you could
Oh
easily
yeah.
turn it into generalization.
Yeah, again, getting back to students being the best teachers, it must have been in, oh, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, just a kid said, "Let's do something more fun." And I said, "Like what?" And he said, "Let's play a game. Let's do XYZ." And I said, "Oh. Okay. Okay. What?" I think I was just so intent on and getting the musicianship instilled upon them, and that was the most important thing to me. And just having that kid say, "Let's do something fun. Can we learn this in a fun?" It wasn't exactly what the kid said, but like, okay, all right. So yeah, every class we're gonna do a Kahoot, or we're gonna do a Blueket, we're gonna do something fun, or the parachute's gonna come out. We can learn in a fun way. Absolutely. Let's have more fun. And I really have noticed that since I started instituting these games, I get a lot more buy-in from the students in learning the material if you can reach them at their own level and do it in a fun way.
Yes, that's so important. And, in our own defense, I think I can't speak for anyone but myself, but I didn't even want to teach until I discovered music learning theory, because then I saw what was possible for students' musicianship. Like, I'm going to be honest, I don't even like kids. There, I said it, everybody out there. I really, like, I'm not the person who's been like, I just want to teach because I love kids. It was really, wow. students can do that musically, then why? I want to help that happen for as many students as possible, right? And I think it's easy to lose sight of that vision, which is a good thing. And sometimes, you know, we also, I think MLT tends to draw a certain type of personality, right? Like very having that, just very drawn to like logical and orderly thinking and very detailed oriented. It's easy to just get mired in those details when we're trying to bring about that vision.
Yes.
And the fun, I mean, that's how we do what we do. And a good reminder too, that there was someone I know who I had seen in some Gimmel workshops and stuff. This was, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago. And, you know, a year or two later, I ran into her and I'm just making conversation. Oh, hey, you use music learning theory. You do some music learning theory. And she said, no, not anymore. I found it took the joy out of teaching. But it doesn't have to.
No, it doesn't. There's no reason why we can't have fun and have them learn something.
Yes.
No reason.
So you've already mentioned some ways that you've adapted partial synthesis to work for you, to work for your students. Any other tips, anything you've realized in teaching partial synthesis that we haven't already covered?
Yeah, my only last piece of advice is just to remind you that the patterns that you're using in partial synthesis should be patterns that are already familiar to students at the aural, oral, and verbal association levels, because if you don't, then you're mistakenly abridging students to generalization.
Yes. We've all done it, or at least
we
I have.
Have.
Before we shift topics, one last question. Do you have a favorite partial synthesis activity, like a song or a chant that works well, or a particular way of prompting them to give their responses?
Oh, there's just so many. There's just so many. One idea I got from you in elementary general level two is to associate a movement for macrobeat. No, associate a movement for duple meter and associate a movement for triple meter. Like your astronaut chant, the astronaut chant, right? So we start in duple and then we move to triple and you give them the movement for each, and then you tell them that you can swap things up, and then it becomes a little generalizationy, but you've given them all of the answers. And then you just start chanting, like I know Cindy does as an example. All the ducks are swimming in the water, faldy, raldy, raldy. So we're rocking from macrobeat, or we've got do-day, do-day, and we're moving to macrobeats and microbeats. And then when we do it in triple, we're going, all the ducks are swimming in the water, and they're rocking side to side, they're rocking side to side. And then you might say something like, could you audiate the movements that might go along? And I'm going to change back and forth from duple to triple. And I think that's important. That's another great thing I learned from Jen Bailey, is giving them a chance to audiate first before they do it. So can you audiate the movements that would go along? All the ducks are swimming in the water, faldy, raldy, raldy, faldy, raldy, raldy. All the ducks are swimming in the water, faldy, raldy, 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 ray. And then now do the movements. So let's review what are the duple meter movements? Do day, do day. What are the triple meter movements? Sway from side to side. Now close your eyes as I'm singing and do the movements. That way they're not like looking around, and you can get a really, really good sense of what they're doing, and they're not self-conscious because they're looking around at other people and nobody's looking at them. And then you do that again, and just change the order, because you've really technically already done the whole thing in duple and already done the whole thing in triple, so it's technically familiar.
Right, exactly.
And if it's a little Love generalization, it. Who cares? So
long as you know.
Yeah, as long as you know. And then just watching the absolute train wreck that happens the first time is just so fun. And then you would want to do it a second time, and maybe even the next class, let them go home and go to sleep and let them audiate while they're sleeping and let their brain do that work for them.
Yes, and research suggests that that is indeed the case, that while we're sleeping, our brain is still working. Things are settling and working themselves out. Yes. You know, I swear, I think partial synthesis is like this hidden gem in music learning theory. It's something that makes MLT truly unique, the focus on context. And I think there's so many playful ways we could be teaching it. And it just, you know, we need more carriers of the lore who are, I'm sorry, creators of the lore, not just the carriers. Don't just teach it the way, you know, we've been talking about, but come up with new ways where students are still practicing the same, you know, essential skills of comparing contexts and recognizing which is which, but we could do it with a prop. We could do it with, you know, little manipulatives. I don't know. There's a bunch of ways you could do it. So it is ripe
Absolutely.
for more creative teachers to just come out and make up some fun activities and share them with the rest of us.
In my choral warm-ups, we do lots of little games. And here's a good tonal partial synthesis activity, because I know you're going to switch to ask me about the choral level in a little bit. But so there's this, I'm going to bring my microphone over here just to make sure that you can hear me over at the piano. So one of the warm-ups that we do, it's a fun little thing. I think it's an old camp song, and it's called Bim Bum. And it goes like this. Bim bum, bim bum, biddy biddy bum, biddy bum, biddy biddy bum, bim bum. Bim bum, bim bum, biddy biddy bum, biddy bum, biddy biddy bum, bim bum. And you can Google it. It's on YouTube. And there's movements that go along with it. It's like clap, snap, clap, snap, pat, pat, snap, pat, snap. There's words that go along with bim. There's a word that goes along with bum. And then there's a word that goes along with biddy. And so we do that for a couple classes, and the kids have fun. And then I come in and I do the same song, but we do it in minor. Bim bum bim bum, biddy biddy bum, biddy bum, biddy biddy bum, bim bum. Bim bum bim bum, biddy biddy bum, biddy bum, biddy biddy bum, bim bum. And so when we do it in minor, I change the movement on the bim bum bim bum on the biddy to turn it into a hand clap, a pat with another person. So there's one little bit of movement that's different with minor. And so we do that for a couple classes, and it's fun. And then I come in on the third class, and I say something like, all right, now listen to this bim bum song. And it's going to change back and forth between major and minor. See if you can audiate the difference between major and minor. And I might play something like this. And so there's a couple key places where I can change the tonality so that they have to go from snapping to patting another person. There's only a couple places where I can change it, if that makes sense. So it starts off like I would probably do like bim bum bim bum, and then change it there. Biddy biddy bum, biddy bum, biddy biddy bum, bim bum, and then they have to get ready. So again, I always use the piano because it's super hard, but it's just
right.
It's an absolute train wreck. But I love. The train wreck that happens and trying to hear them. Can they do it? Can they do it? It's just a lot of fun.
So it's a train wreck in the best way. And like, and we're both still smiling and loving the idea of it, because even, I don't know, you probably couldn't see me, or I don't know if you could hear me, but as you were modeling the first time, and I thought you were going to Dorian, and there was another thing I wasn't expecting. And even just if the kids are responding by going, ooh, right? Like they're hearing the differences.
Yes.
Amazing.
And I guess it technically was Dorian if we do a minor tonic, and then we should. Because it was technically.
Yeah, that's super fun. Well, thank you for transitioning us into a choral idea, because yes, I did also want to make sure that before I let you go, we talk a little bit about the new choral track in the Gordon Institute for Musical Learning Levels courses. So you were part of the team that said, why don't we have a choral area? Why don't we offer a training in the summer for choral teachers to learn how to use MLT? We need to make this happen. So what was that like being on the team?
We did. We made it happen. I know it's been a long time coming. It's been a long time in the works. What, 10, 15 years, something along those lines. I think that really Crystal McCoy was the real impetus for making the whole thing happen. She went back, 10, 15 years ago. She worked with Ed, and And I think Ed said, let's make this happen. And so, you know, people have been working on it behind the scenes for a long time. And then finally, all the pieces of the puzzle came together and it just clicked. And it was just amazing working with Crystal and with Natasha Sigmund, another Gimbel faculty member, and Amy Pearsall, and Butch was part of the committee. It was just great figuring out what a PDLC really, really is, and using the Elementary General as a model, and kind of deconstructing the Elementary General PDLC and putting it together and figuring out, well, what are the things that would normally happen in a choral classroom, and how do we adapt those things in a PDLC with an MLT framework? So we looked a lot at the warm-up process, and how can we take the warm-up process and filter it through an MLT lens and multitask, and as opposed to doing the same. Yeah, la, 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 la. La, 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 la. How do we take that and add some MLT spice on it? The teaching of repertoire was discussed. There was a subcommittee that focused on repertoire. There was a subcommittee that focused on musicianship. There was a subcommittee that focused on the LSAs and what do LSAs look like in a choral classroom. And then we just put it all together, and Crystal was the glue, and she made it look all pretty and put it together and submitted it to the board. And it was approved. And we ran our first level last summer, and it was just mashed potatoes and gravy. I had an absolute blast.
That is so fantastic. And just a side note, I had Crystal on the podcast last fall, so I'll link in the show notes for anyone who is wanting to go back and listen to that episode. And then you started mentioning last year's inaugural first ever choral levels course. What was that like to have the very first group of participants?
Oh, I really could not have asked for a nicer, stronger group of musicians, stronger audiators, and they came really, really very well prepared. There was eight people in the class, and again, just unbelievably strong musicians. We had people travel from South Africa. We had people travel from Australia. We had two people from Germany. So people were coming from all over the world to study with little old me, and Crystal, and it was so inspiring. And I think that it was really, really inspiring for them as well, just to see what is possible once you teach students through an audiation framework, rather than just always plunking and repeat and put on the concert. Yeah, you got to do some plunk and repeat, and you got to put on your concert. This is true. But we can also teach them how to be musicians as well.
Yes.
And so I think there was so many aha moments. Like, I can just picture this one guy's face. Like, after I explained a thing, he just went, like, what have I been doing? And I said, all right, pause, just relax. We are all approaching this from our own unique perspective. you know, don't judge yourself for where you've been at all. You know, we're all doing the best that we can. We've all done the best that we can. But I just love seeing those aha moments from each and every one of those students. And a lot of them had taken at least one level before. So it was almost like a level two within a level one. There was so many, many great questions that kept me on my toes.
Yeah. I won't name names, but I might have a guess as to who that person was. And like, and it's when you, like when I mentioned, when I finally discovered, when I could hear the musical things possible from students with the appropriate guidance, like it just, yeah, turns everything on its head. And I got one of the best emails during that course with you. You know, I don't do this podcast for money. Gimbel pays for the, you know, the web hosting fees or whatever the jargon is. But like, I don't get paid. I just do it because I love it and I want to help more people use these ideas. And so it's really those positive words that motivate me to keep doing it. And I got an email when you were teaching that course from somebody from Australia. And I think the subject line was like, I'm at a PDLC and it's all your fault. And the email was all about how this person was just loving the PDLC, the Coral PDLC, and a big driver in it was just like discovering, MLC more through this podcast and then making the commitment to come over and learn from you. So thank you for your work.
Of course, once people discover MLT, is as if it's been hidden on under a rock somewhere. But once they discover MLT and realize what students can do, what students can do as musicians, it's pretty life-changing. So if you haven't had the opportunity to take a PDLC, I would strongly recommend it. I can't recommend it enough. Please try to find the time if you're a choral professional and you want to learn how to teach students to be singers and musicians, which it's possible. It's possible. That's a great place to start.
And doubly exciting because New Mexico is the farthest west we've had a PDLC. And we also have one planned for Texas. So
Go West, give us go
onward.
West.
Well, I won't keep you. Last question as we wrap up here. Can you offer any sort of a tip, a takeaway, a hack, a pearl of wisdom for someone who teaches at a choral setting and wants to try a little MLT?
Well, if we were to talk about sight, quote unquote, sight reading, I think it's really, really important to break down the reading process for students and to explain to them the reading process. And so this happens all the time in my classroom, when we're working on quote unquote sight reading. I always bring it back to the language analogy for the students in my class. I always bring it back to, the first year of your life, you didn't do anything. You just listened, eat, sleep, pee, poop, cry. Eat, sleep, poop, peep, cry, and listen. A lot of listening. And you were listening to your parents speak pretty sophisticated sentences. They were not just saying doggy, kitty cat. They were speaking pretty sophisticated language. So develop your listening vocabulary and then develop your speaking vocabulary. When we're growing up, you just point to things, dog, cat, chair, hat, mommy, daddy, and you're just naming things. Well, we do that in music too. This is our music vocabulary. Do do day. Do da dee do. Do mi so, so fa re ti. Do so do. La do mi re ti si. La mi la. So that is our musical vocabulary. So if you don't know that musical vocabulary, well, learn it. How do you learn it? Well, I give all my students. That's one problem I think with sometimes with MLT is that we hold all of the material and that it all belongs to us and they have to come to our class to get that material. Well, I like to have the material ready for students. So I put together all these materials. I have a book called The Choral Musician. I'll have to get you a copy. A book called The Choral Musician, and it's got all of my patterns in, and I quote, not my patterns, but the patterns that I use. And it's me teaching them and giving them the audiation gesture. So I say to students, if you don't know these patterns and you miss them the first time, maybe you were absent, or maybe you're like me and you need to hear things 78 times before you understand them. Well, go back, learn the patterns. So once we learn the patterns, then we need to discriminate major, minor, duple, triple, and then we start to read those patterns. Can you read those same musical words that somebody taught you? Can you read do mi so, so fa re ti, do so do? If you can, great. Can you read two patterns? Can you read do so do, so fa re ti? And I have these little videos with me teaching how to read these patterns. And again, if you can't do it, go back and watch the video again, because we're all right here. We're all reading ba da 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 ba 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 da ba ba. And if you can't do that, then there's a problem with your chain. There's one of the pieces of the chain is missing, and you got to go back and fill it in. You need some help? Come and make an appointment with me. But this is the process: audiate patterns, compare contexts, read patterns individually, and then combine tonal patterns and rhythm patterns into musical sentences. And if you can't do it, then there's either an audiation problem, let's fix it together. Or there could be a vocal or a technical problem, and same thing, let's fix that problem together. Sometimes for the cis boys, for the boys in the class, oftentimes we are reading up here, like in D flat, D major, and E flat major, and that's not the best key for them. So that could be not an audiation problem, but that could just be a voice problem. Not even a problem, but just, you know, the teacher needs to put that in the more appropriate key. So for your sixth grade boys who are up here, if they can't do that, if they're in the middle of the voice change, put it in B flat for them. Your sixth grade boys are going to love this. Do, mi, so, so, mi. So that's the main thing that I would say. Teach the reading process to your choirs according to the way that we learn language, and let students in on that process and make them part of the process. Let them know where to get the help if they need it. I have this little steps to sight reading document that I put together, which links to all the videos. So it's really up to them. They need to have ownership in it as well.
That's amazing. Could you tell listeners if they want to check out some of your materials? And I understand you self-publish some things that are available for purchase. If people are interested in checking those things out, where can they look for them?
Oh, sure. They can go right to the improvingmusician.com. A couple of the most recent things that I've put out a book called The Choral Musician. So it takes students basically through what I call the audiation foundation. So macro, micro, duple, triple, major, minor, tonic and dominant, just a basic series of patterns that they can establish in an audiation foundation, and how to read those patterns and then put those patterns together into quote-unquote musical sentences. And it was requested by some people in the Music Moves community. They really wanted those same materials for piano students. So I took those exact same materials and put a new coat of paint on them and wrote a book called Piano Patterns. And that's available also on my website. And are we going to give a free copy away of either Piano Patterns or The Choral Musician to someone who's interested?
Well, you know, if you're offering, we might as well.
Yeah, let's put on a... So you can send an email to everydaymusicality@gmail.com.
Yes.
With either Piano Patterns or The Choral Musician. And then Heather will do a drawing, and whichever person wins, you'll get a free copy of either Piano Patterns or The Choral Musician.
Beautiful. I love that. And I'm going to be super nerdy. Would you please put in the subject line, just in capital letters, I love audiation. And then in the body of the email, you can just put your choice of those two resources. Oh, awesome. Thank you so much, Andy. We appreciate it. I'm so grateful that you took the time. I know you're very busy, and this has just been a lot of fun. Thank you.
It's been great. Thank you so much for doing this, Heather. I know a lot of people have gotten a lot out of this podcast.
Excellent. Well, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Andy Mullen. And if you'd like to enter to win a free copy of one of Andy's books, make sure you email me at everydaymusicality@gmail.com. by June 1st, and then I will plan on announcing the winner in the episode that comes out for the first week of June. In the meantime, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch. You can email me or send me a voice memo at everydaymusicality@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and let's keep musicking every day.